Hey there, welcome to LiveWire. I'm your host, Luke Burbank. We are going to get artsy on the show this week, but not in like a snooty way, by talking to New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake. She's been cartooning for years and is now trying to help the rest of us learn how to turn our creativity loose with this thing called Joke in a Box that she's come up with. It's basically a 70-card deck full of exercises and ideas to inspire your joke writing and drawing. Then we've got another incredible artist, Tessa Hulls, who, when she wasn't serving as an unpaid radio DJ in Antarctica or traveling the world, spent almost a decade literally inking a graphic memoir. It's called Feeding Ghosts and looks at the history of her family. Then we're going to hear some music from the phenomenal band Pure Bathing Culture. It's going to be a fascinating and fun hour of LiveWire, which I'll get started right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke, how's it going?
It is going really, really good this week. I am excited to play another round of Station Location Identification Examination. This is the part of the show where I quiz Elena on a place in the country where LiveWire is on the radio. She's got to guess where exactly we are talking about. Okay. In 1939, after a great day of marlin fishing in this place, President Franklin Roosevelt bestowed this town as the White Marlin Capital of the World.
So maybe, I know he had a vacation home in Georgia, and there's marlins maybe in Florida. So is this somewhere in Florida?
It's on the eastern seaboard, but you're going to go north. You're going to get a little closer to D.C.
Oh, it's in the Chesapeake Bay area.
Okay, now you're warming up. The boardwalk in this city has been a beloved attraction for over a century. It's over 2.5 miles along the beach. It's got, of course, shops and eateries, and it is considered the place to be in this part of the world.
That's got to be Ocean City, Maryland.
Ocean City, Maryland is exactly right, where we're on WYPO radio. Also, if we would have needed to, I could have deployed this little clue for you. The guy who invented Noxema apparently came up with it at Ocean City, Maryland, because the people were getting so much sunburn and windburn, he whipped together this thing called prescription number 22, which then they later changed the name to Noxema.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Shall we take that momentum and roll it right into the show?
Let's do it.
All right. Take it away.
From PRX, it's
LiveWire.
This week, cartoonist Emily Flake.
It was a father and a teenage daughter, and he's looking upset, and the caption is, I'm not disappointed, I'm just very, very mad.
Artist and writer Tessa Hulls.
I did my damnedest to never tell this story. Like, I ran as far away as I could get, and I mean that literally. Like, I went to Antarctica trying to get away from this.
With music from Pure Bathing Culture. And our fabulous house band. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello. And now, the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank.
Thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thanks to everyone tuning in from all over the country, including Ocean City, Maryland, home of Noxema. Probably, if we can believe the internet. We have a really fascinating show in store for you all this week. We, of course, asked the LiveWire listeners a question because we're talking to Emily Flake about comedy and joke writing and creativity. We have asked the listeners to tell us their favorite short joke. We had to put that in because, you know, sometimes they can be real stem winders, but we're going to hear those responses coming up in a minute. First, though, we got to kick things off with the best news we heard all week. This is our little reminder at the top of the show that there's some good news happening out there in the world. Elena, best news that you heard all week.
Okay. This is some Maryland news, actually. Very apropos. So we have to go back to 2014, which is when our story begins, at a billiards competition, a pool competition in Laurel, Maryland. The prize for this competition was an all-expenses-paid trip to a pool tournament in Las Vegas, so the stakes were high, and a pool player named Russ Redhead was up against... I know these names are great. Was up against a guy named James Harris Jr. And now James Harris was rated lower than Russ Redhead, so he actually got to start at some kind of an advantage, but then he crushed this game. To the point where Russ Redhead was kind of suspicious, and he took his suspicions onto Facebook and sort of disparaged the good James Harris Jr. And James Harris Jr.'s pool friends got online and let Russ Redhead have it. And they were like, you need to really think about what you said, because that's not true. And contrary to what usually happens on Facebook, Russ Redhead was like, you know what? Maybe you're right. And when they met 6 months later at another pool competition, he apologized. And that was basically all it took to strike up a long, long friendship. These guys, Russ and James, met each other at competitions. Sometimes they do sports betting together. And there was a little bit of a secret happening, or actually a lot of a secret. James Harris wasn't telling Russ, or really anyone in his life, that he had end-stage kidney disease. He was getting dialysis 12 hours a week. He wasn't able to work. He was on the wait list, but it's a 5-year wait list for a kidney. And it wasn't until 2022 that Harris's wife was talking to Russ Redhead and let the beans spill that this was something that James Harris was going through. And Russ Redhead was like, what does it require? What do you need? Sweet, I'll do it. So 2 months ago, they had the surgery. The night before, Russ Redhead spent the night at James Harris Jr.'s house. His wife got them T-shirts that said Kidney Buddies for Life and forced the men to wear them. There are these great photos of the Washington Post of the two of them in their hospital beds and pre-op fist bumping each other. And I'm so happy to report that everybody is feeling great and the two can't wait to get back to playing pool again. And they are still the best of friends and the harshest of rivals.
I love that story. I want you to know, Elena, I would absolutely give you a kidney if you needed one. Although I've put some miles on this rig, so I don't know what the Carfax are on it. I'm not sure if you want it, but just know it's available if you need it.
Thanks, Luke.
Well, from the sport of billiards to the sport of hockey, the best news I saw this week comes to us from the Cleveland, Ohio area, where recently a mom named Asia Davis was at a Cleveland Monsters hockey game of the American Hockey League, and she had her 4-year-old kid, Nasir, with her. And she says now, because she's talked about this whole story, that this was maybe not Nasir's greatest night. Like right as the game was starting, he started to say, I'm tired, I don't want to be here. But they had already like gotten the tickets. And, you know, she was like, we're sticking it out for the game. And sitting next to him was some guy, they didn't know him, some dude in like a backwards hat, who Asia Davis says was being surprisingly patient, sitting next to her son, who was kind of going through a bit of a meltdown. And so I don't know, about midway through the game or something, just out of the blue, there is this moment in the game where the puck, which is very heavy, a hockey puck is really dense, gets knocked up in the air. It goes over that kind of protective glass, and it is about to hit Nasir in the head. Nasir, by the way, oblivious to all of this. He's just being 4 years old. This mystery guy whacks the puck away from Nasir's head at the last second. So she thanked the guy. She took a picture with him, and she, you know, they pretty much at that point decided to call it a night, and they went home. So it's like a day later, and Asia Davis can't sleep. She just keeps playing this over and over again in her head, how close this puck came to hurting her little son and just how bad that could have been. And she realizes that she wants to thank this mystery person, but she doesn't know anything about him. She didn't get his name or anything. Well, of course, she did get a photo, though, so she throws that up on TikTok. And the next morning when she wakes up, basically her post is like, help me find this person who like saved my son. There's like 600,000 people have shared this video. She's gotten all these responses, including from the guy who did the saving. He's 28. His name is Andrew Podlak. And he said, hey, no problem. I was like happy to help. The hockey team, the Cleveland Monsters, of course, heard about this, invited them all back. So Nasir and Andrew got to do the puck dropping at a game. I'm not a super kind of supernatural type of person, but this guy, Andrew, told Asia that he actually had tickets in a few different sections. And he was just sitting in the seat next to this kid, Nasir, even though this kid was being kind of wild. He could have sat in a number of other seats that he had, but he stayed in that seat. He told Asia Davis that he feels like he was sitting in that seat for a reason that night, which is pretty sweet. So the fact that everybody in this story, Elena also made it out in one piece health-wise, is that's the best news that I heard this week. All right, let's welcome our first guest on over to the program. She's a staff cartoonist for The New Yorker. She also performs something that she calls stand-up cartooning, which I think might be a singular art form for her. It's she shows cartoons that she's made via PowerPoint, and then she tells stories about them. Her latest project, though, is something called Joke in a Box, which is a 70-card deck full of exercises to teach the people that are participating in this how to write a joke and also how to kind of unlock the humor in their brain, which is something that we can always do more of on this show. If you've ever heard my attempts at humor, you know I can use all the help I can get. So here we've got some. It's our interview with Emily Flake. We recorded this live on stage at Town Hall in Seattle, Washington. Emily, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How do you describe joke in a box to people? What do you say this actually is?
Honestly, I usually just sort of stammer around saying, like, it's sort of a book, but really it's a creativity deck. But a creativity deck just sounds like a, like, dumb. It's a deck of cards with some advice and things on it. I guess, like, the I Ching of comedy.
This is one of the few audiences that would even get that reference.
It's a dirtbag Brian Eno. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a little more pitchfork than I think this crowd is ready for, but okay.
I trust you guys.
One of the things that you point out in this sort of project is that I think you say something like cartooning is not a growth industry.
No.
That there's basically the five people that work at The New Yorker, you're one of them, right. And like two or three other jobs in America. Why did you create this thing that could potentially make you the Mr. Miyagi to someone's Daniel-san, who will then crane kick your job away from you years from now? If this works, someone's gonna come take your job.
Well, I figure either they'll take my job or they will be unable to take my job. And either way, it's an act of cruelty.
Right.
So why not?
What was the first cartoon that you drew for them?
So it was a father and a teenage daughter, and he's looking upset, and the caption is, I'm not disappointed. I'm just very, very mad. That was the first one. Not my favorite one, but the first.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you about maybe one of your favorites a little bit later, but I'm also curious, you also teach classes and courses, and so what this joke in a box thing is kind of distilling that down mm-hmm. into something that, you know, people can buy and bring home with them. Why
exactly.
did you want to do it in this format?
For money.
I'm not mad at you,
right.
Emily. I'm just disappointed that was your answer.
Again, fair. No, and also it seemed like a nice way to sort of like distill it for myself. I enjoyed writing the exercises and advice in there. Basically, all the pep talks in here are pep talks I would give myself if I liked myself at all.
It is very, I have to say, encouraging. You know, it's sort of like really taking down some of the barriers that people might assume would be in place, like being able to draw or think creatively or be funny, which actually, would you right. mind reading this card, page 7, what if I'm not funny?
Sure. What if I'm not funny? I like that you're laughing already at the what if I'm not funny. A sense of humor, meaning an inherent tendency to see the world slightly aslant, a desire to joke about it, and a general attraction to humor cannot be taught. But I'm guessing that if you've picked up this deck, you do possess this sense, and it's one that can be developed. Hopefully the exercises here will help you to explore your own point of view and your own unique way of being funny. If you, holding this deck, do not in fact enjoy humor, please know that I find the fact that you've read this far both touching and extremely hilarious.
Right. Is there a person who cannot do this, or can this be for anyone?
I mean, I think that the person who cannot do this is the person who does not like jokes and has no interest in writing jokes. I think that anybody who is interested in writing humor, it's kind of like their joke stem cells, that if they want to put those into this particular niche format, I think they can, you know, bend their talents to their will. But yeah, I think you have to at least want to write jokes.
Uh-huh.
I cannot lead a horse to water that doesn't want to write a joke.
Is that also a premise for a cartoon that you've done? Have you done a horse being led to water and then something funny happens?
Well, I'm going to do that this week.
This is Livewire from PRX. We are talking to New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake. Now, when we get back, we are going to pull some cards out of this joke in a box set that Emily has created. And we are going to put our drawing skills to the test. And having been there, I just want to tell you all, manage your expectations. It's coming up in a moment here on Livewire. Welcome back to Livewire. I'm your host, Luke Burbank. I'm here with Elena Passarello, and we are listening back to a conversation we recorded with the New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake about her latest creation. It's called Joke in a Box. Let's take a listen. This was recorded live at Town Hall in Seattle, Washington. What are some of the exercises that are in the box? What are some of the things that you kind of run folks through?
So a lot of the box is just cards with a prompt, not even a prompt, like an object on it. And so there are ways that you can pull cards by chance and then put them together in a way that forces a juxtaposition that you can pull something out of. So if you pull a person, place, and thing, you put it together, and it's kind of like making your own caption contest.
For folks that don't know, the New Yorker magazine has on the back page now cartoons that don't have captions, and you try to send in your ideas. And it's something that, as a person who I consider myself to be reasonably funny, I have never had one good idea for that. It's just not how my brain sort of operates. Do you ever participate in those under a pen name, or do you read those every week? Do you try to win those just for your own kind of gratification?
No, I feel like that would be illegal. No, I do not.
Do you look at them?
Not really. Unless they've pulled one of mine for the caption contest. I mean, all of us cartoonists, I sound like we're some sort of cabal. We all have a slightly ambivalent relationship to the caption contest.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Sam Gross, who recently passed, he said it in a much more profane way, but he was like, I hate that thing. It makes anybody think they can do this. So,
well, wherever you are, Sam, just know it makes me think I cannot do this.
Yeah.
I'm so bad at it.
But I didn't know this. So you might get something that you've submitted, you, Emily Flake, to the New Yorker, pulled and then put on that back page as fodder for the contest.
Yes.
Perhaps even without your knowledge?
No, they tell you. Okay. And it's a little humbling because they're we're going to pull this for the caption contest. And you're basically saying, we think somebody else can do better.
So they erase your caption.
Yeah.
You've submitted it with a caption and they block it out and then just throw it to the sharks.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
My mind is blown.
Is this too much how your sausage is made? Is this ruining it for everybody?
I love it.
I am an extremely bad drawer. I had a Garfield rendering that I tried to perfect in fifth grade that was pretty bad, but was like the one thing I could kind of, you know, just I like drew it over and over again the way you do when you're a kid trying to get like what your thing is.
Right.
So I found it very gratifying here in Joke in a Box when you sort of mentioned that you, even though you're a professional cartoonist, that you are insecure about your drawing sometimes?
Sometimes. yes, like 100% of the time.
Why?
Because I, well, that's a really interesting question. I guess my real answer is because I don't think it's very good.
You feel like your actual drawing skills are not where you wish they were?
Yeah, right. I think I'm like a middle of the pack, solid B minus, like not as good as the people that I truly admire. And not as bad as people I don't like.
So like not Barry Blitt, but not the guy from Family Circus?
Let's not be mean to the guy from Family Circus.
You're
He's
right.
doing a perfectly serviceable job.
There's no way that's still the same dude.
No, I think there's like, actually just like a machine that does those now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not AI. It's like some kind of one of those perpetual motion water birds that just makes a thing where little Billy has wandered around the yard and there's like a broken line behind him and it goes over the swing.
It's you nailed it.
This has already been an extremely visual episode of Livewire. In a notoriously visual medium, radio.
Radio.
I guess this gets me to my next question, which is I feel like really the humor is the important thing when it comes to a cartoon like this, like a one-panel joke, versus the drawing. Like the drawing, it seems to me, is there to serve the comedy. Like there's a funny idea. A dad says to his kid, it's not that I'm disappointed in you, it's that I'm very angry.
Right.
That's a joke, and then you just have to make the dad look dad-ish enough and the kid, like, right? Is that really the order of events? It needs to be a funny idea, and then the illustrating of it is just kind of there to support the joke?
That's how I think of it, but I think of, like, because I always write first, I think I just privilege the writing. And I think the drawing can either sell your joke well or undercut it. But there are like perfect gag cartoons where it's like a really beautiful marriage of the two, or it's just a pure visual. So yeah, I mean, I would say in my own work, a lot of times I'm just drawing two puppets to say a line to each other. Like, I'm like, this is a nice line. Let's put them in a person's mouth.
This is Livewire Radio coming to you this week from Town Hall in Seattle, Washington. Have fun. So I was thinking that maybe we could really, really test my sort of theory that the drawing is secondary to the humor, or that you don't have to be great at drawing to make a compelling one-panel joke.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we could test that by actually doing one of the exercises in your Joke in a Box,
sure.
Emily.
Sure, on the radio. Absolutely.
Yes. So what we're going to do is have you grab a couple of cards as kind of suggestions, and then Elena and I are going to have 60 seconds to try to draw a cartoon based on whatever it is that you grab at random.
Okay.
Now, we've also asked the house band to gin up some creativity music, which they're going to be playing for this 60-second exercise. And Emily, I'm going to be deep in concentration on my art. So could you try to just, could you kind of handle the radio hosting and maybe do a little color commentary about whatever it is Elena and I are doing?
I absolutely can do that, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Just please pick at random.
You've got dragon and supermarket. All right. And so you have 60 seconds to do this?
Yeah.
You better get going. That's not very long. And so I think the important thing to think about is what could go wrong at this? Like, if you just draw a dragon shopping, like, there's not that much happening. Like, why is the dragon miserable?
Yeah.
Like, what is the dragon trying to do that it can't? What would make a dragon, what would be unexpected or surprising about a dragon at a supermarket besides just like
that's exactly what I'm going for here.
Does like character work? Like what's the dragon's motivation?
Yeah, what exactly? What is its motivation? What's its emotional truth? I think that's an important thing to get at. Wow, that dragon is a lot. I mean,
this idea is not getting any better from here, I gotta tell you.
But I mean, listen, I believe in both of you.
Okay. Here's what I got. Mine is supposed to be a dragon incinerating everyone in the self-checkout line, asking, anyone in line here?
That's solid.
Well, let's see what Elena has come up with, and then we'll
I only know how to draw one thing.
Is it a dragon?
No. It's an upright base. So I drew an upright base at Costco saying, gee, I wish I was a dragon.
Wow.
No. No fair.
The fact that you came up with that workaround for the problem in 60 seconds is stunning.
That's impressive.
Yes.
Your dragon.
There's a lot of problems with my dragon. The dragon looks like, you know, in the original Little Mermaid cartoon when Ursula takes someone's voice? My dragon looks like Ursula took its voice. But also the drawing. I think the issue is that I don't really think a dragon should incinerate people in the self-checkout line. I think he should incinerate whoever invented the self-checkout line. And that person's not at the grocery store.
They might be, which is why he has to incinerate everybody to make sure.
I feel like they're collateral damage. They're just trying to get through their life.
Exactly. Yeah.
If I gave you those cards, Emily Flake, professional cartoonist, dragon, grocery store, where does your mind go with that?
I mean, I automatically make him sad because that's what I go to first.
Sad dragon?
Sad dragon. Like, you know, he's sad because he's at the supermarket. Like, you know, I always imagine that, like, whatever he wants, he destroys with his dragon
breath.
Right. Yeah. Oh, poor dragon. So I like to put things in a position where I feel sorry for them.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of my work has like a base layer of pity and sorrow.
But like
that's great.
Like basically, what would it be like to be a dragon at the grocery store? What are the things that we don't think about as non-dragons are the hassle of being a dragon?
I mean, I would think about how awkward it would be to like move through the aisles, because as a non-dragon, I feel that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I live in Brooklyn, and the supermarkets are very tight, and I am not small, and then there's like I never know where to put my body or my cart or my eyes. So like if I had a tail.
Right.
Forget about it.
Or like if you sneezed, you just like incinerate a baby.
Exactly.
That
it's
would be
happened.
Bad. This box, Emily, it's a bunch of exercises to kind of get a person in motion sort of when they're trying to be creative. And I'm wondering, I mean, is that really the hardest thing, is to go from not doing anything to doing something?
For me personally, yes. And I don't like to think that I'm so unique that I'm the only person that feels this way. Yeah, for me, it's the like push into the actual doing.
What do you think is one of your sort of favorite cartoons that you've done, even though you've mentioned just how much you're sort of tortured by your own thoughts of inadequacy?
I think the one that I've done that I like the most is a family sitting at a dining room table. The father looks very crestfallen, and one of the kids is speaking. And the caption is, does this mean we have to scrape the daddy decal off the minivan? I want to thank the audience for giving me exactly the laugh I wanted out of that cartoon.
What?
You can all sleep well tonight.
And also, what we didn't mention, the daddy is a dragon.
Yes.
Yes.
So there's that. Emily Flake, the new project is Joke in a Box. Thank you so much. That was Emily Flake right here on Livewire, recorded live at Town Hall in Seattle, Washington. Make sure you grab yourself a set of her Joke in a Box cards, and make sure you check out her work in The New Yorker. Hey, special thanks this episode to Laura Frizzell of Portland, Oregon, and Charles Passarello of Atlanta, Georgia. Laura and Charles, a.k.a. Tony, are part of the Livewire member community. Some of them have very familiar last names even. And they're generously supporting us with a donation each month. And we are thankful for that support, because it's how we are able to keep this whole thing going. So thank you so much, Laura and Tony, for supporting Livewire. This is Livewire. Each week, we like to ask our listeners a question. Since Emily Flake was helping us expand our creative and humorous abilities, Elena, we asked the audience to share their favorite short joke with us this week. You can always use, you know, a couple of good, like, short jokes in your back pocket if you got to break them out at, like, some kind of an awkward, you know, dinner meeting or something. So people have been sending these in. What are you seeing?
Well, I think because of the prompt for this to be short, people went full pun.
All right. I wouldn't call that promising.
You like grumbled and I was like, woohoo, these are good. Okay. Hey, Luke, this was from Brody. Why don't ants get sick?
Why, Elena?
Because they have little antibodies.
That's pretty good, actually. I haven't heard that one before.
Okay, how about this one from Serena? What did the janitor say when he jumped out of the closet?
What?
Supplies!
All right, pretty solid. Maybe one or two more. These are going fast, though, so that's the good news. We can actually get a lot of them in.
Okay, how about this one from Michael? You know, a lot of people don't find Cleopatra attractive, but that's not how Julius Caesar.
That's actually good. That's my favorite one so far. I need to write these down, and I need to laminate a card that has like three or four good jokes, because have you had this experience? You hear one like that and it's actually pretty funny and you think, oh, I've got to remember that to be able to, you know, deploy that on my friends at some point, or maybe my nieces and nephews. And then I can never remember those kinds of jokes in the moment when called upon to do so.
It would be really funny if you had a laminated card that you pulled out at moments like that. Like, you would develop a really interesting reputation.
That would officially be the end of even any last vestiges of me being a young person. That's not the move. But anyway, well, thank you to everyone who sent in. Those are actually pretty good. The Julius Caesar one really got me. We have another listener question coming up for next week's show. We're going to read you at the end of today's episode. In the meantime, though, let's say hi to our next guest. She's an artist whose wanderlust has taken her everywhere, from Antarctica to Ghana to China and Hong Kong. She was in China and Hong Kong with her mother as part of an attempt to really better understand herself. It's all described in her new graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts, which traces three generations of women in her family from China to Northern California and through mental illness, and eventually to an understanding of the complicated ways that mothers and daughters can both damage but also save one another. This is our interview with Tessa Hulls. We recorded this at the Patricia Reeser Center for the Arts in Beaverton, Oregon. Tessa, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
This book is really incredible. The book kind of starts with your grandmother, Sun Yi, who is living in China. She's a journalist, and she meets a Swiss diplomat and ends up having a child. The Swiss diplomat kind of bounces, and she is now a woman, a Chinese woman, raising a mixed-race baby alone in China in the 1950s.
Yep, that's
what
the
is that? What does that look like for your mom and her mom?
Complicated?
Yeah.
That's the short answer. Basically, so my grandmother, she wrote for pro-nationalist newspapers, and when the communists came to power, she found herself caught in the crosshairs of this really complex history. So she was being intermittently arrested, held for unknown periods of time, all while raising my mother, whose biracial identity was politically really dangerous.
And then they managed to get to Hong Kong, and there your grandmother writes her memoir, which is this, like, smash hit. How did that change their life?
It both did and didn't. So because of the bamboo curtain, there really wasn't news coming out of mainland China. And so after they fled, there was this huge built-in audience just wanting to know what was happening on the ground, because the communist government had just shut down the press and stopped all communication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my grandmother, I also learned through reading her book, she was very smart, she was very calculated, and she was aware that not only did she have this amazing historical narrative, she also could write this kind of salacious romance about, you know, this white man. And then after she was pregnant, she needed support. And so she had a series of men who essentially supported her. And so when the book came out, it was an immediate bestseller in Hong Kong and Taiwan. And goes without saying, you could not read it in China, banned book. And so that's where it should have been a happy point in their story, because everyone was telling my grandmother, your ship has come in, you're going to be safe now. But unfortunately, she was only paid for the initial print run, and the book ended up being pirated, and she received very little money. So what she did get, she used to put my mom into an elite colonial boarding school. And that's where my mom learned the High Queen's English that basically gave her access to the social class and path to the U.S. that she eventually took. And that's when the real tragic side of the story starts, where my grandmother then succumbed to mental illness. She had a mental breakdown and was institutionalized in Hong Kong's first mental hospital.
I mean, the book is called Feeding Ghosts, and it's really something that you grapple with. It sounds like the version that you mostly knew of your grandmother, at least growing up, was almost a ghost of the person that she had been in China and in Hong Kong. What was your sense of your grandmother growing up, the version you knew in Northern California?
Well, I really wasn't able to have one because my mom didn't teach me Chinese and my grandma didn't speak much English. And she also spent most of her life really heavily medicated. And all she ever did was rewrite the same story of her past. And I don't mean that as a metaphor. Like, she literally would not leave her room. She sat at her writing desk and is endlessly scrawling the same stories over and over and over again. So there was really no way in until I was able to commission a translation of my grandmother's memoir. And that was the point at which her story began to unfold for me.
That's such a crucial part of the book for me, that just, it's so striking that you had this family story your whole life, that your grandmother was this famous author, but you didn't have access to the book in a way that you could read it, and you had to commission someone to translate it for you so you could get the story. Did it meet your expectations or exceed your expectations? Or
I think I went into it without expectations, because how could I possibly know what was in there? And because there was a lot of footwork needed for this project, I was doing the research and writing for many, many years before I really did any of the actual making of the book. And so while I was waiting for that translation, that was basically when I began to address my own vast ignorance about how my family's story nestled within the broader strokes of Chinese history. Because I didn't really understand that I had been raised to think of a fairly radical political stance as normal, where in my family it was always the communist takeover, not the communist liberation. And I really didn't realize that my grandma had been this stridently anti-communist voice at a point where that was incredibly politically dangerous. So that, to me, I think was the most striking realization, was that the political dissident side of my family was something I just was unaware of.
We're talking to Tessa Hulls about her new graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts, here on Livewire this week. We are in Beaverton at the Reeser. I read an interview with you in the New York Times where you said when you decided that you were going to take on this project, all you needed to do was basically learn Mandarin, learn how to draw a graphic novel. And I forget what the third thing was, but it also seemed really hard. Why did you decide you wanted to kind of use this format, something that you were going to have to really learn in terms of the graphic novel part of it, graphic memoir?
I think that decide maybe gives the choice more agency than was there. There's
this
line.
To.
Yeah. So there's a science fiction writer named Connie Willis, and she said in an interview once that when people ask writers, where do you get your ideas? It's like asking Humphrey Bogart in The African Queen, where do you get your leeches? And so my background before I started this book, my most established career was as a painter. So I came up in the visual arts, and I drew the whole thing by hand. It's not digital. It's all done in Japanese brush pen, and it's almost 400 pages. And I calculated that it's 4,000 square feet of ink.
Wow.
So,
oh my God.
Yeah, it took a while. But I knew for me that doing this as a graphic novel and having that tension between the words and the images and the negative space that arises when I had those contradict or play off of each other in unexpected ways was the only way that I could really tell this meta narrative about how we choose to craft a story. And so in that sense, drawing it was was a way to allow me to show multiple contradicting realities.
This was not even, almost not a choice for you.
No, I did my damnedest to never tell this story. Like, I ran as far away as I could get. And I mean that literally. Like, I went to Antarctica trying to get away from this.
Did you really have a radio show at McMurdo?
I did, yeah. So there's a radio station down there. And
did you have more listeners than us? Because that's going to hurt.
No, I don't think... I mean, I don't know how many people are in this auditorium, but there aren't many people listening to the radio in Antarctica.
Okay, all right. Phew. What was the show about?
Well, I called it Poor Life Decisions, and the radio show, or the radio station, was ICE 104.5. The logo is a penguin in front of a radio tower.
But see, okay, so this sort of relates to, it sounds like a way that you processed a lot of really intense emotions, which was, particularly with you and your mother and that dynamic, which was to go to the furthest flung places that you could find. It sounds like you spent your 20s just anywhere that wasn't home. What did you feel you were trying to get space from?
I think I was running away from a sense of duty and denying in a lot of ways, I think, a really a common experience for children of immigrants of feeling like you have an obligation to your parents' past, but as an American, don't necessarily know the way in or feel able to face it. And I think I also realized that if I entered into this story before I was ready, I wouldn't be able to survive telling it. And so I think the fact that I began shortly after my 30th birthday, it was sort of the first moment in my life where I recognized that all of this running away had given me the skill set and the tenacity to be able to enter this story and survive it.
So you and your mom then go to China and Hong Kong to kind of research your family and for her to introduce you to people from your family's history. And it really sounds like, or reads like in the book, that that was an incredibly important sort of bonding experience for you and your mom.
Yeah, I remember one moment in particular. We were walking down a street, and she saw a sugarcane vendor, and she just tugged on my arm, and she said, "Oh, Tessa, look, look, it's a sugarcane vendor. I used to love sugarcane." And just the look on her face, I had never seen her like that. I had never seen her unburdened and unguarded. And it was incredibly powerful and incredibly heartbreaking as well, because it made me realize that until I traveled to China with my mother, I had actually never seen her in a context in which she belonged. And it was as though this immense sadness that she always carried was lifted for the first time, and I was able to see the possibility of that ease for her.
Well, I thought it was interesting that if I read it right, I'm reading the whole book, and it's you're really speaking so honestly about your experience being the child of your mother. And I'm thinking, oh my God, is her mom reading this? And then you write, this is a collaboration at some point. You describe the book as a collaboration. How was this a collaboration for you and your mom?
So the first step for me in this book was writing my mother and telling her, okay, I'm ready. I need to do this. And I thought it was going to take me about 5 years. Here we are 9 years later. But I think I embarked on this in an attempt to heal my relationship with my mother. And so we had many, 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 many long conversations, me interviewing her, me asking her for the touch points and references that made her who she was. And eventually we were able to get to a place where I think we understood that the conflict between us really was rooted in cultural misunderstanding in a way that we hadn't been able to see. And it's definitely not a happily ever after story of, oh, and now we understand each other and we like get manicures. But it's more, we can leave room for each other's emotional truths without trying to fundamentally overwrite or change who the other person is.
I'm curious about promoting this book that's so personal, because it's your life story and the story of your family, and yet it's also a product that is for sale. I read an interview with one of your editors who described you as, I believe, almost unfindable. Does that mean this is the first and last, like, graphic memoir, graphic novel
yes.
work
yes.
from you?
Yes. But no, to elaborate on that somewhat, I think what I've really been learning in this journey is that I'm not somebody who is a writer. I never had the ambition of making a book. I never thought of myself as an author. And as this has kind of moved further along in the process, I've been thinking about this phenomenon called homoplasy, which is where you have animals that share, or not just animals, plants as well, but basically things that look similar. So you think they have a shared genetic ancestor. So like a shark, an ichthyosaur, and a dolphin, they all have really similar forked tail fins. So you think like, oh, somewhere back there. No. Divergent. And so homoplasy, that's the term for it. And so I think what's happened is a case of homoplasy where I'm like, I am a multidisciplinary artist who's making a book, making a book, making a book. And I've been doing it for so many years that people are like, oh, well, she must be want to be an author and make a book because that's what she's doing. Where the whole time I've been like, this one story requires me to do this one thing, so I'm going to do it. But I've never had that aspiration.
Oh, cool.
Wow. Well, as a one-off, it's a hell of a project. And you've always got Antarctic DJ to fall back on. So Tessa Hall's The Book is Feeding Ghosts. It's really incredible. Tessa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Tessa Hall's right here on Livewire. Her book, Feeding Ghosts, is out and available right now. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Elena Passarello over there. We have to take a very quick break, but do not go anywhere. When we come back, we are going to hear some music from indie pop band and Livewire favorite, Pure Bathing Culture. So stay with us. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to LIVEWIRE from PRX. I'm your host, Luke Burbank, here with Elena Passarello. Okay, before we get to our musical guest this week, a little preview of next week's show. We're going to be talking to Aparna Nancherla. You've probably seen her all over TV and Netflix with her acting and also her really funny, very droll stand-up comedy, which I love so much. Aparna now has a memoir out. It's titled Unreliable Narrator, Me, Myself, and Imposter Syndrome, Comedy Legends. We are going to hear from Gary Gulman, the very, very funny stand-up comic. And we're going to get some music that also serves as a bit of a history lesson from No-No Boy. It's going to be a great episode of the show. We cannot wait to play it for you next week. In the meantime, though, we do have a question for the listeners for next week's show. Elena, what are we asking folks?
We would like you to please tell us about a time in which you felt like an imposter.
Ah, okay. So that'll be connected to Aparna's book. So yes, if you felt like an imposter at some point and you want to tell us about it in a possibly humorous fashion, or not, just whatever, hit us up. We're on social media at LiveWire Radio, pretty much everywhere. This is LiveWire from PRX. Our musical guests this week are a duo with a knack for making music that sounds otherworldly, but also very familiar. And maybe that's because it is familiar to you, particularly if you've caught them over the years opening for Death Cab for Cutie or The Shins, or have listened to one of their many critically acclaimed albums, the latest of which is Chalice and features songs about the search for transcendence and joy. Pure Bathing Culture joined us on stage at the Patricia Reeser Center for the Arts in Beaverton, Oregon. Take a listen. What song are we going to hear?
This song's called The Memento.
All right, this is Pure Bathing Culture right here on LiveWire.
I dreamt an island. I caught it from the corner of my eye. Yeah, I saw you as an apple. apparition in the sky. You were alone and you were crying. A ruby rose above the stars' form into a ghosted lover's charm. I saw you rising with a crimson angel arm in arm. I saw you rise, an apparition in the night. You were looking for a light, like a memento to keep alive, like a locket, like a ring, alive, like a memento to keep alive, like a rocket for a king, like a ring. The light, like a memento to keep, yeah. The light, oh, like a ring. Ooh, the light, like a ring, like a locket, a memento for your pocket, like a ring. And through the silver of a keyhole, an apparition in the night, I saw a crimson rose, a ghost above where angels fly. I saw you dreaming with your eyes closed tight. I think you're looking for a light, like a memento to keep alive, like a locket, like a ring, a light, like a memento to keep alive, like a rocket for a king, like a ring, like a memento to keep, like a ring, like a memento to keep, like a ring, a crimson ghost upon the wing, like a ring, like a locket, a memento for your pocket, like a ring. The light, like a memento to keep, yeah. The light, oh, like a ring. Ooh, the light, like a ring, like a locket, a memento for your pocket. There's a light in your pocket, it's a memento to keep, like a ring, like a locket, like a rocket for a king. There's a light in your pocket, it's a memento to keep, like a ring, like a locket, a memento for your pocket, like a ring. The light, like a memento to keep, yeah. The light, oh, like a ring. Ooh, the light, like a ring, like a locket, a memento for your pocket, like a ring.
Pure Bathing Culture, right here on LiveWire. Their latest album, Chalice, is available now. All right, that's going to do it for this week's episode of the show. A huge thanks to our guests, Emily Flake, Tessa Hulls, and Pure Bathing Culture.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. And our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. Eben Hoffer, Leona Skinner-Kinderman, and Molly Pettit are our technical directors, and our house sound is by D. Neil Blake. Trey Hester is our assistant editor. Our marketing and production manager is Karen Pan. Rosa Garcia is our operations associate. Jackie Ibarra is our production fellow, and Becky Phillips is our intern. Our house band is Ethan Fox Tucker, Sam Tucker, A.L. Alves, and A. Walker Spring, who also composes our music. This episode was mixed by Molly Pettit and Trey Hester.
Additional funding provided by the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. LiveWire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank members Laura Frizzell of Portland, Oregon, and Charles Passarello of Atlanta, Georgia.
Tony P!
That rings a bell. That might even be your actual dad. Hey, if you would like more information about our show or how you can listen to our podcast, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank. For Elena Passarello and the whole LiveWire team, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Whoa.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have a piping hot episode of Livewire delivered right to your heart and ears each week? Well, guess what? That can happen when you subscribe to the Livewire podcast feed, and you'll get the joy of surprising conversation every week. So go ahead and do it. It's super easy. You click on the button at the top of your podcast app, and bam, you are Livewire subscribed. And if you're still, you know, feeling the love, if you're enjoying the show, hey, maybe you could hook us up and leave us a quick review. That'll help more people find out about Livewire. And thank you.